Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicle Companies and Markets Show. I am John Heumann, editor of the Investors Chronicle. I've been away for a couple of weeks, but the team have done a sterling job in the interim. I've been busy writing essays and also overseeing loft conversion work, which is now complete. But I'm sure we'll come on to that in a minute. Won't we, Bradley Gerrard, when we talk about Kingfisher?
We will, exactly. Yeah, a bit of a refurb and, you know, overhaul going on there.
Good, good. And Mark Robinson, how are you doing, Mark?
Very well, John, very well.
And we're going to talk about the oil price and the fallout from the oil price plunge on one of the companies you cover, Plexus.
Indeed, yes. It's rarely out of the news of late, the oil price plunge, but we'll get back to that in a moment.
Indeed. And Harriet Russell, how are you doing, Harriet?
Yeah, good, good.
Excellent. We're going to talk Tesco, aren't we?
We are.
Wonderful, wonderful. Not been a great week for them, but not terrible either. Could have been worse.
It could have been worse.
Okay, let's start by talking more generally about what's been going on in the world at large this week, as covered in 7 days. Bradley, what have we got to say this week?
I guess one quite interesting story which made the front of the FT yesterday, I think, was this whole Soros versus China battle, which is quite interesting. I mean, George Soros obviously famed for his shorting of sterling back in the early 90s, I think it was, when the UK was forced to come out of the ERM. He basically just said in the TV interview one of the asset classes he was betting against was Asian currencies. He didn't even actually name the Chinese renminbi. But the day after that, the People's Daily, which is sort of like the Communist Party's kind of mouthpiece, suggested that Mr. Soros's war on the renminbi and Hong Kong dollar cannot possibly succeed. So it's quite interesting because obviously if Soros is shorting renminbi, it's kind of just indicative, I suppose, of a view on China that obviously, you know, we talk about China a lot on the podcast and how fast it's growing and what problems the economy might have. So I just thought that was interesting and worth flagging up. Just because of the amount of coverage of China and just an interesting sort of tit-for-tat battle that might be going on here.
But it is a managed currency.
So, well, exactly. I mean, I'm not a currency trader, but it seems to me that China has the economic clout, if they deem necessary, to start buying up US dollar assets at an increased rate. And, you know, where does that leave him then?
Well, he obviously sees the amount they've been spending in out of their reserves so far to try and kind of keep the renminbi. You know, it seems like they're slowly unpegging it. It's not the peg is not perhaps quite as hard as it has been historically. So he sees, therefore, that given the strength of the dollar, that the renminbi will weaken and that while China might spend money protecting it a bit, it might not spend as much as it has done in the past.
But wasn't the usual criticism anyway, at least from the United States, is that the currency was undervalued?
I think so, yeah, but it's been devaluing more, I think, in recent times. That's what caused the problems in August for the stock market.
And also the fact that the stock market there is not exactly a normal stock market in any sense of the word.
Well. Yeah.
But there you go. Okay, so good luck, Mr. Soros. I think the Chinese economy is perhaps a little bit stronger than the UK economy was back in 1992 when he made a killing there. But there you go.
Right. It'll be
there
an interesting move. And, I guess as well, I mean, another thing that's worth maybe just talking about quickly is oil. I mean, as you mentioned in the intro there, HSBC did a note this week that sort of looking at the average price per barrel, it's predicting would be $45, and that's down from an estimate not that long ago that it would be $60. And then the World Bank went one further and predicted an average price of $37 per barrel this year. So the outlook for oil is looking quite bleak, and that's obviously having the impact on emerging market countries which export commodities. And that, I suppose, links quite nicely to the fact that Aberdeen again has suffered some outflows. Aberdeen Asset Management, which is sort of emerging market and Asian equity specialist, you know, it's
not actually Aberdeen.
No, not the well, the city.
Although, you know what, having you said that, I read a story this week that you know, demand for property in the UK, one of the worst places for property demand was Aberdeen.
Wow,
which must be related to the oil industry.
Well, this links into our Plexus article a little bit later on. But actually, I was talking to the company's editor Ian Smith about this morning, and there's been any number of economic studies which highlight the link between a fall in energy prices and a converse rise in GDP. But we must be approaching this point now, and I don't think there's as much literature on this, which suggests that a prolonged period of weakened energy prices might have the reverse effect on the global economy, as it takes away aggregate demand over a period of time. I mean, I'm not suggesting this is what's happening at the moment, but surely economists must be looking at this.
I think the question's been asked whether the falling oil price rather than representing a simple supply demand imbalance on the basis of oversupply, actually represents a massive weakening of demand.
Yeah, that's the point. I mean, the point with the oil price is, well, in of itself, it's relatively meaningless. But what does make, what is important is, you know, 3, 5, 10 years ago, what people were thinking what the oil price might be now. That's the significant figure, because obviously long dated capital projects were put it or initiated on this basis. So, I mean, like any other commodity price or any statistic in isolation, it's pretty much meaningless. But we've obviously overbooked and oversold or overcapitalized on oil prices above $60 a barrel, and goodness knows where we'll be this time next year. The one thing I would make a point, and this is a general point as well, is that what's happened over the last 18 months with the Saudi-backed OPEC position is that it's storing up pressure on oil prices to come. We're going to see a spike well above $100 a barrel at some point in the future, because so much future production replenishment has been taken out. I've quoted this before, but the Wood Mackenzie have come out with a figure of 20 billion barrels so far. And this is an unconventional supply. This is long-dated projects, offshore, onshore, things that you just can't actually turn around in 6 months or a year. So at some point in the future, because demand is still rising, let's not forget that last year...
And this is driven by Far Eastern demand.
Well, exactly. Let's not forget that as oil prices were falling last year, we hit a record for annual demand growth of 1.8 million barrels. You know, it's pulling back this year. But you know, when markets approach equilibrium and then tip over, you're going to see a very sharp correction.
On the upside.
On the upside.
Absolutely. Which I agree with. I agree with that. I just don't think we know when the end is in sight of the current problems.
It's like calling markets. It's a fool's game, really.
Falling knives. Falling knives. Although it has been bouncing this week. And the market bouncing with it, which is very unusual. I mean, usually markets and oil prices move in the opposite direction. But it's been very unusual. Oil is bouncing back this week, but...
Yeah. Well, I was talking to a few guys from Gulf Marine Services last week. These are two Scotsmen, been in the industry for years, and they said this is unprecedented in terms of a depression, price depression on a percentage basis over a period of time. And it's a manufactured one as well, but anyway.
I do remember that, you know, in the 90s, when, Soros was having his pop at the pound, you know, oil prices were, $15 a barrel.
Yeah, for a period there,
but a long period.
Yeah, was that purely? I can't speak with any authority on this. I was round at that point, but I'm just trying to think of the basic market fundamentals. Then I'm trying to think why they were so. What was the US dollar doing then? That's a point.
But who knows, Robert? Who knows? I think we need to go away and have a rethink before we reinvestigate.
Answers on the back of a postcard.
Absolutely. But, low oil prices are nothing new, I think is the point. But they may rise in the year ahead. And I think you're right to mention that, projects are being basically canned.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the general consensus is that we're going to start to see some retracement during the third quarter. But it's, finger in the air stuff. I mean, that's the general opinion. But the general opinion hasn't... been correct for the last year and a half. And
indeed. Okay, so we might as well, before we continue with 7 days, Bradley, let's talk Plexus, because I guess, the whole oil price thing now is, for some of the smaller companies out there, it's a survivorship thing, It's about, can these explorers hang on for long enough to survive this period of depressed oil prices? And I guess someone like Plexus, who's involved in providing the kit, for these guys. Is it a similar position?
Well, that's right. The thing is, Plexus has been hit pretty hard. And I do mention in this week's article about an oil equipment stablemate, Hunting. Both these are really high quality companies that we've covered in the past. And they're well managed, highly experienced boardroom operatives. And in the case of Plexus, I mean, it provides... I don't know if I can actually say this, but I think the Plexus offering is based around technical excellence and proprietary IP there. They provide wellhead systems and have major benefits both in terms of production and, above all, safety and manageability.
So I think it's been said that, Plexus technology had been used over in the Gulf of Mexico, Deepwater Horizon, it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah, the general feeling of the Macondo, right, you'd have still got the blowout, but they'd have been able to, because of the technology, no moving parts, it would have been around, you know, within 72 hours, we might have had a cessation of the well there. But regardless of this, as I say, this is an equipment manufacturer, and so it's been hit particularly hard because of the fall away, particularly in North Sea remits as well. I think the lion's share of its revenues still come in from the North Sea, although even prior to the fall away in crude prices, the company had been headlong in a diversification program, and they've had some real success in this with a couple of state-owned equities in Russia, or state-controlled equities in Russia recently, and also a major oil service provider in China. So the good news is, as well, is that as far as I could tell, there hadn't been any sell-off for any of the major institutional holders, you know, BlackRock chief amongst them. And also, I looked at the volumes, and it was erratic trading patterns after the profit warning, but the volumes weren't particularly high. You know, it has got liquidity, the stock, but obviously the share price is a little bit volatile as a result of its size. It's well capitalized. It's got decent sort of access to finance at the moment. So we don't see there's any sort of existential crisis. The only thing I would say, and I mentioned it in the article, is that given the position, you might actually get some of its larger US rivals coming in. I mean, there's always the...
As a bidder,
because there's always the fear. And I have no indication from the company on this point. I mean, not that they would give it anyway, but there's always sort of fear that they would go and see the institutional holders and say, tap them up, basically.
I mean, you've written about oil services, oil equipment and services more generally in the FTSE 350 review that we published this week as well. I mean, it's not a particularly happy place, but, you know.
No, it's the old inverse picks and shovels argument, isn't it? Because whenever you see an uptick in oil and gas markets, it's the oil services that respond first up, and it's the converse is true as well. It was the first dip. Again, it's if you look across the market as a whole, those companies that have high exposure to the North Sea are the most exposed. And this isn't in the 350, of course, but those Gulf Marine Services, who I mentioned before, have got a pretty interesting mix because most of their, or at least, actually, in fact, the majority of their contracts are linked to national oil companies and also to companies based out in the Middle East region where the revenue streams are far more predictable.
Well, I think we've written a piece, Ian Smith has written a piece this week on Iran. And obviously the sanctions in Iran were lifted last week while I was away.
Yeah,
I think it was.
There's a huge opportunity.
Massive opportunity there. And I think a lot of people are saying, well, you know, the sector's had a tough time, but there's some big contracts up for grabs out there.
Well, absolutely. You've had over 10 years now of where the local infrastructure has been degraded. The capital hasn't been there to sort of maintain it, let alone improve upon it. And so these are huge opportunities for UK oil and gas providers to get in there, not only in terms of production, but also in terms of refining as well, because like many of the world's largest oil producers, Iran has to import a huge amount of finished product, and sort of that has a tremendous impact on their balance of trade. So if the political situation remains stable, that's one sort of bright cloud on the horizon.
Absolutely. I think a few eyebrows are raised when we put, you know, Iran on the cover, saying, you know, next big investment opportunity. But it's kind of turning out that way by the looks of things.
Well, yeah. It extends to other areas, luxury goods, for instance, on the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, absolutely.
And cosmetic surgery.
I'm just looking at the chart of FTSE 350 sector performances over the last 12 months, Mark, and out of the bottom six, you've got four of them.
Yes, as I'm sure many.
It's been a fun year.
I'm sure many of our readers have already noted. It's been extraordinary, really, and what it points to, as I mentioned earlier on in the piece, is that. All of this relates to assumptions on prices 5 and 10 years ago. That's where we are. The industry is overshot, and now there's a severe correction underway.
And many people are saying it's overshot on the downside, but that, I think, remains to be seen. Another sector that's done very badly, seventh worst performing sector, food and drug retail. Harriet.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, fun year for you too.
Yeah, grocery is, I mean, I think we've started the intro to the 350 piece on a really optimistic note, which is that basically it's as turbulent as it's ever been for the last few years at least.
I mean
deflation is a huge problem in food retailing, and it's not going away anytime soon.
So Tesco is the big story this week in that sector. It's a kind of funny story, really.
It's a bit of a funny story because basically this week, to summarize, the groceries code adjudicator, which is sort of a new position, kind of, certainly her powers at least are only slowly becoming determined. Anyway, she ruled this week that back in 2014, when the Tesco scandal broke, they did in fact violate the code by not paying suppliers appropriately. In normal circumstances, this would warrant a fine. She's unable to fine them because her powers were not as they are now back when it happened. So they will avoid a fine, but that didn't stop plenty of news outlets running with the story.
Yeah, I mean, it's a funny story that it's kind of like not really news. We kind of knew that Tesco had been behaving very badly.
Bradley and I deliberated long and hard on whether to even sort of cover it, I suppose, because we thought, well, this is not new. We knew that they had violated something. We knew that four executives had been fired. We knew that it was serious. And, you know, there was a lot of talk at the time about whether they would be even sued, you know, had they violated the law. So we sort of looked at it and we thought, well, what are the questions that come out of a ruling from a watchdog like this? And we decided that the prominent question was really still around corporate governance. Can shareholders in Tesco really trust management to have turned over a new leaf? Can they trust that drastic Dave Lewis has done enough to really change the culture at that company so that if you want to invest now for recovery purposes, we have our own view on that, but if you did want to do that, can you trust that your money is going to be safe this time around?
Well, I guess Dave Lewis wasn't there when these things happened.
No, he wasn't, but he had actually been in the post for about 3 weeks prior to it breaking.
So, but you might suggest that he kind of knew that something was up. He had actually been working at a supplier to Tesco.
Yes, he had. So, I mean, it's all assumptions. We can only judge from our sort of glass house over here. But, you know, let's assume that he knew what was going on. He was brought in really as a rescue chief executive to kind of take the situation and manage the fallout.
And got this bad news out quite quickly.
Well, he got it out just before, like a day before their actual results, I think.
I wasn't actually covering the sector at the time. It was our ex-colleague now, Julia Bradshaw. But yes, I remember it breaking. And as I said, he fired four executives on the spot. So I think there was quite a demonstrable effort at zero tolerance that this was not going to be how Tesco would act in the future, especially under his leadership. So you can assume that. However, in our piece this week, we've sort of done our due diligence of our own and gone around some of the sort of, not watchdogs, but sort of bodies that really look out for investors' interests on corporate governance levels and spoken to them about what their views are on how Tesco has managed the scandal so far and to what extent it's a thing of the past.
Well, I think it was a smart move on his part. You know, I think he has to do something big when he came in.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, he's not going to turn around a juggernaut like Tesco in its entirety overnight. But, you know, Tesco had long been accused of you know, nefarious practices. I think it was a smart thing to go after straight away.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously they had a better than expected Christmas trading period. And I think what's also interesting, speaking to a few people from things like investment associations and things, is that they all say, you know, now Tesco, operationally speaking, financially speaking, is going to be held to such high standards because they don't just have a financial performance to rebuild, but they have a huge trust issue with investors in the market at large. So hopefully, you know, they can demonstrate some sort of corporate governance measures and initiatives that will improve that. And then if they can keep building their financial performance, there's no reason to suspect it can't come back from the brink.
Did you get any feel for whether this was, this treatment of suppliers was a Tesco-specific issue, or this is something that's more of an industry-wide problem? I mean, you know, a grocery code adjudicator would not need to exist were it just one company behaving badly.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to one person who asked to remain anonymous, but their view was certainly that this is an industry wide problem. This is not just Tesco at all, and you know, I think other grocers are paying the price elsewhere. You know, the big four, let's assume that people like Morrisons, Asda are involved in, or have been involved in this. You know, Morrisons has paid the price, even if it hasn't come out and said we've not paid suppliers properly. You know, it's basically had to exit convenience. It now doesn't have a convenience chain. You know, Dalton Phillips did enough mismanagement of that business to drive it pretty much into the ground anyway. So it's not like everyone else doing it behind the scenes and getting off scot-free. It's not, you know, performance-enhancing drugs type stuff. It's just, I suppose, what part of mismanagement comes out quicker.
Well, you say it's not performance-enhancing drugs, but it's, I mean, it's performance-enhancing financial management.
And, yeah, it's performance-enhancing accounting, for sure.
So it is a kind of creative accounting thing that makes companies look better on a certain point in time than they perhaps otherwise are.
I mean, I can say that as a former auditor. You know, timing issues can mean a profitable year or a loss-making year. It depends when you book the revenue. It depends when you book the profit. That's no secret. And financial directors up and down the country, the globe over, are involved in creative accounting. Sometimes it's perfectly legal.
But then you get into interesting realms of, you know, a company's responsibility to its shareholders. Mm. So, you know, is a company's responsibility to maximise the profit that it makes at the expense of suppliers to give better returns to its shareholders? Or...
No, it's
or
not.
Or is it more important to run a business that is equitable for everybody involved, even if shareholder returns suffer a little?
So companies law, actually, we did take a little look at this week as well, and this is what has put some people in the mind that Tesco, there are actually grounds to sue management. Because really, companies law, there's a directive in there about directors' responsibilities. I think it's section 172, if memory serves me correctly.
That's the one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read that too.
Yeah. And it basically states that, you know, the director's responsibilities are to be honest and fair to shareholders and transparent about their activities. So you can assume that Tesco is absolutely not doing that. And not only to shareholders, they have to be fair and honest with their suppliers as well.
Well, I guess there's an expectation among investors as well. They don't want to be, you know, investing in companies which actually do bad things.
No, I think there's always a sort of moral issue to investment, which is sort of a whole topic within itself. And depending what sector you're looking at, those issues become spliced in different ways. But I think everyone would like to think they're doing the honourable thing and that the companies they're investing in. I mean, the problem with something like Tesco is that obviously it's not just, and this is another thing we discovered this week, it's not just retail investors that necessarily are managing their own portfolios or their own holding in Tesco. Very often they're invested through funds. Mm. So they also have a hidden layer of having to trust the fund manager that's working with their money by putting it in something like Tesco. They have to trust that their fund manager's not thinking, oh, well, that'll be fine. I'm sure these issues will work itself out. So it's layers and layers of trust.
Yeah, I mean, the whole ethical investment thing has been a bit of a minefield, and you know, Bradley, you've probably covered this in your previous role, but never the greatest performers. But
no, I mean, there are the odd ones who do very well. I mean, you know, Kames, a multi-asset ethical fund, and it's done very well. Audrey Ryan, I think, is the manager. Done very well. There are examples of good performance, and performance that keeps up with non-ethical peers, if you can sort of say that. Mm. But yeah, it's a tough space, and I think the toughest thing for investors is actually there isn't a one rule fits all thing. You know, you have to, if you're going to invest with a house through their ethical fund, you need to read what ethical to them means, because it chances are it'll be different.
Oh yeah, I mean, I've looked at it in the past. There've been plenty of companies, you know, certainly oil companies, for example, many people don't think are ethical.
Well, why hasn't someone mandated an unethical trust?
I'm pretty sure there is one in America, actually.
Is there?
Yeah, there is a vice fund in America.
Yeah. Well, I would
guns, tobacco, and booze.
It'd be interesting seeing the returns on that.
Yeah, it's not that great. I mean, you know.
Well, tobacco's been pretty good the past decade.
Yeah, actually, guns are doing really well at the moment over in the US. Well, Smith & Wesson is listed out there.
Yeah.
I think they had the best sales ever.
I'd just like to caveat that tobacco has done well because it's justified itself through its dividends. It's not that operationally fantastic.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, let's talk dividends, actually. That's a good segue into the Capita story, which you put together this week, Mark. So we've got the latest dividend monitor from Capita, and it's looking a bit iffy.
Yeah, I mean, we covered it at the third quarter mark, and at that stage, Capita were predicting a slight increase over 2016. But of course, there had been a run up there with a number of companies either canning their dividend or slashing it back. And again, this is a lot of this is linked to the resource space as well. But I believe Standard Chartered as well did they pull their dividend?
Yeah, I think they did. Didn't they?
Yeah. Well, there's been a few other high profile ones, and so basically Capita of saying that we're going to see a pullback in this year. It's not a dramatic pullback, but it's substantial enough. About over £3 billion pounds has been taken out of the system so far. I guess the only the only sort of glimmer of hope there is that we're expecting more US dollar strength for the remainder of this year, and around about 40% of UK dividends are quoted in US dollars. So that's going to transfer capital, yeah, saying upwards of $1 billion in terms of that currency benefit at the moment. So bearing in mind, of course, that the last 2 years have been quite strong anyway. Last year was strong in special dividends. The year before was unprecedented because of Vodafone's sale of its Verizon Wireless stake as well. So while it's certainly not positive, there's still a pretty good dividend pool out there in the UK, I think.
Mm. I think the thing that struck me about it was their comment that they are far less certain about the outcome for the year ahead than they've been in a long time. And I think that is the thing that struck me about the report. And I guess that's one thing that investors need to be mindful of, and you know, aware of, you know, if they've got stocks that might cut their dividend, or how cover is shaping up, or maybe see it as an opportunity to buy into companies whose share prices might now be depressed because they have cut their dividend, but the chances are it might come back. So there's quite a lot to think about.
Sounds like my entire portfolio.
we'll have a better idea, obviously, because we're just entering the full year reporting season at the moment, and there's probably going to be some nasty surprises in there. But
well, like, there were some figures out from Ernst & Young recently which suggested profit warnings were on the up. Yeah. Probably higher than we'd seen since 2009, I think their figures suggested. So
well, it could be just a bit of housekeeping as well. I don't want to underestimate the difficulties that companies are facing at the moment. But when we're swinging into a downturn with the economy at the moment, companies tend to get bad news out the way fairly quickly.
Mm. Okay, Shell, they're a big dividend payer. Vote this week in favour, amongst Shell shareholders, in favour of the BG takeover. So that's good news, potentially.
Yeah. Well, I think it's good news. I think the deal itself still makes strategic sense. I think we were speaking about this the other week, and there's been a lot of press comment about the fact that in line with the fall away in energy prices, the deal no longer made any economic sense. But it seems to be an absurd position anyway, because when the deal was originally formulated, the oil price was taken into account, but it wasn't the be-all and end-all. It's a strategic move which will allow Shell to increase the proportion of LNG and natural gas, mm-hmm, that they supply to world markets. It made sense at the time for BG as well, who were facing some problems after years of seeming progress. They had problems with their offshore assets in the Santos Basin. There's the whole issue over down in Brazil with the Petrobras scandal. And they were undercapitalized as well. And so, you know, the union to me seemed to make perfect sense, and it still does.
Yeah, it makes sense to me. I've got some BG shares. Yeah, please take them on me as quickly as possible. Shell's dividend, there's been a few worries about that, but you think it's safe?
Yeah, I think so, but if for no other reason that management is prioritising it as well. I mean, Shell, along with BHP Billiton, have got a tremendous record in sort of sustaining dividends and increasing them over the years. It's one of the reasons why, we've seen some weakness in the share price of late. That's only to be expected, but it's a major reason why the shares are so well supported. I mean, of course, they're heavily mandated as well. But I can't imagine any circumstances this year which will see a cut in Shell's dividend. Oh, my God, did I just say that?
Yeah, okay. Well, thanks, Jonah. We'll blame you when it all goes wrong. Just to go back to what we were saying about the performance of Vice, in what was a pretty dismal year for the market, tobacco up 7.2%, beverages up 6.8%.
There you go.
There you go. Defensiveness still has its attractions. Okay, let's come back to you, Bradley, and wrap up the news. Thought the Andrew Bailey appointment at the FCA was quite interesting and surprising.
Yeah, it's going to be quite an interesting one, that, because the view is, I suppose, that the Andrew, who's been at the Bank of England about 30 years in various roles.
And he's the Prudential Regulation Authority chief at the moment.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, his signature's on banknotes. So if you might recognise the name, that might be why. He's going to be heading up the FCA now. And so there's the early kind of reaction to this is that the force, I suppose, of the FCA upon banks and asset managers might now be a little lighter than it has been under previous guises and previous chief executives, which actually, I mean, you could argue maybe that it's time for that, because our banks are now very well capitalized. I mean, yes, they keep getting fined, but they keep being able to pay these fines and they keep increasing their tier one capital ratios. So you could argue now maybe we can sort of let the reins out a little bit them anyway.
They have already paid a lot of redress for past misdemeanors.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, the level of bank fines over the past few years has been astronomical.
I mean, you could argue there would never be enough, but I mean, they've paid billions of pounds in fines and they are being a bit more responsible in terms of their lending. I know I'm trying to remortgage at the moment and they ask a lot of questions
they
now.
They do ask a lot of questions. Yes, I've been there.
Yeah.
I mean, you could also suggest perhaps then this is an appointment that is really designed to get banks moving again in support of the economy.
I think so. And I'm pretty sure it was on the FT yesterday. I was reading that I'm not sure he actually applied. I think he was sort of asked, would you like the job kind of thing? I'm sure he has the right credentials, absolutely. But
surely when your name is on banknotes, you don't have to apply for jobs.
Well, maybe that's the level he's obviously reached. But I mean, obviously, obviously the chief executive of the SCA is always going to be a political appointment. They're meant to have a Chinese wall between them, but let's be realistic. So
there's a point to consider as well. A lot has been made recently, the fact that most bank lending in recent years, a high proportion of bank lending is asset-based lending. In other words, it's not actually fueling any economic growth. It's fueling asset bubbles. And it's a strategic aim of government, or presumably it is, for them to get lending to small and medium-sized businesses again, which is just not happening.
Not necessarily good news then for the challenger banks, which have been trying to make that their own.
Quite possibly.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Watch this space. One other very interesting thing that you put together, and I'm sure Harriet has a view on this as well, is Kingfisher, which is the new spotlight this week.
Yeah.
A company that has taken an awful lot of my money in recent weeks. Big strategic review there.
Yeah, they had a capital markets day, their sort of one Kingfisher plan. It had been announced previously, but the reason why we've sort of spent a bit of time looking at it again this week is that the financial details of it have been released. So how much it's going to cost, how much they think it will mean the company makes above what it makes now after the plan, that sort of thing. So obviously those numbers are quite important to us and our view on the company, and they'll be interesting to investors as well. I guess the very sort of trying to keep it brief. I mean, I did watch the webcast of the capital markets day. There's a nice story there. You know, management have done their homework. They've been to something like 3,000 customers or something in different countries.
Me.
They didn't ask you. They saw you. You were already a committed customer anyway. So. But they've been around a lot of the customers. They've tried to, in management's words anyway, try to understand, you know, what people want to do, what they're sort of, what they find easy, what they find difficult, what they want, what they like and don't like. And so they're trying to really now make the proposition at Kingfisher more common across the brands, or well, unified. So historically they've tried to get their brands, which include things like B&Q and
Screwfix,
yep, and there's a couple of European brands as well. They've tried to sort of get this unified product range before, but it's been a bit of an opt-in thing. So
yeah, that was always the message they used to give.
And so
it's never really happened.
Not everyone opted in, so
no.
You never had a unified range, whereas Veronique Laurie now definitely wants to have a unified range, low cost always. She said those words quite a lot, so there's potentially a play for, you know, sort of, you know, the squeezed incomes potentially of people, you know, the consumer now. And they're aiming for it's a five-year plan, and they're hoping that at the back end of that, the company will produce £500 million a year more in profits. Along the way, obviously, there's going to be a fair bit of spending. They're in net cash at the moment. They won't be by the end of it. They'll be in net debt, but not a huge amount. And they are planning to return £600 million, likely through share buybacks, on top of their dividend in the next 3 years. So we've left it on hold. I mean, you could say maybe I'm sitting on my hands there a bit, but I think the market's reaction to this initially was negative. The shares fell about 3 or 4%, I think. Things like this have been tried before. It does seem that they are, that Ms. Laurie is going to deliver now. It does seem like there's a bit more of a, right, we're going to have one buying team, we're going to have less suppliers, we're going to work with suppliers to make sure the range is unified, is good.
Well, I hope it's Screwfix's buying team, not B&Q buying team, because I've spent a lot of money, but it's not been in B&Q.
No, well, I think it's going to be an amalgamation of everybody, but there won't be as many people on. There are several buying teams, I think I understand, at the moment, whereas that won't be the case now, and they're going to be working with suppliers to actually design the product, so reducing cost as well. So there are a lot of you want to believe that it'll work. It sounds like they've tried to do the homework here. They've tried to understand their customer. It will be just very interesting to see how that goes. And I think at the moment we're willing to sit on the sidelines and wait and see.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as I said, it's an interesting space. You know, I've bought a lot of stuff recently. I haven't just shopped in Screwfix. A lot of what I've bought for my loft conversion has been online. So, you know, this independent online bathroom retailers and flooring retailers. And you know what? It's easier to buy stuff from them than it ever has been. Tiling retailers, good prices. You know, it's a tough market, I would say, for someone like B&Q.
Yeah.
And I guess that's reflected across the whole industry. It's just, yeah, you know, they're in the firing line of this as much as anyone.
Yeah, I mean, we had a trading update this week from Carpet Right, and I think Topps Tiles is not too far off as well. And the Dunelm, which is another homewares group, they don't really do furnishing, you know, they don't really do sort of hardcore furnishings, they do sort of more soft furnishings. But overall, the landscape was not good over the last quarter, and that's got a lot to do with the fact that high street footfall is so low, which is, you know, just backing up what you just said, which is that everyone's preferring to do their research online and eventually just buy it online. It's just, they see it as easier. I don't know. It is.
And you know what? I mean, you know, if you're buying some flooring, you think, well, you've got to go and see it. But actually, you know, these guys, these independents, their models are getting quite slick. So, you know, for a pound, you can order samples of, you know, flooring, tiling, and, you know, so you get
so the online proposition is...
It's getting so good.
Yeah.
I mean, Topps Tiles, I spoke to their management in depth about this at the last set of results, because I'm fascinated by the idea that customers use online as a research tool and then they go into stores so knowledgeable, more knowledgeable than they've ever been before, so much savvier. And I mean, Topps Tiles management is insistent that it is only that. It is only a research tool, and they very rarely sell things online. They make more sales in store. Personally, I think that's changing. I think it's shifting.
Yeah,
I think so too. I think, you know, Topps Tiles has invested a lot in its technology to make its online site sort of user-friendly and really sort of interactive. But it's sort of a vicious circle, because the more that they do that, the more they're going to see their customers start to just purchase online.
I think Topps are incredibly uncompetitive in their pricing.
Yeah.
I really do. I actually end up buying tiling from Wickes, having gone to a lot of these places, because, you know what, I've checked everywhere out. I'll shop for the best price. Mm. Best product at the best price.
Interesting. Well, we've got a site visit with Topps coming up, hopefully, so we'll be able to see more inside that business.
Well, I'm intrigued. I think they've got a lot of work to do. I think it's getting tough out there. I think the online side of things is, you know, as I said, these independents have really coming into their own now.
Yeah, and on the high street, they're just having to slash prices across the board. I mean, that was the real message out of Carpet Right. I think the shares went down about 8% yesterday. It was pretty drastic, and a lot of it's got to do with margins. They're just having to keep slashing prices to remain competitive, and they're going to have to take a margin hit to do that.
Indeed. I'll tell you what, somebody's the tiling retailer, and in fact the flooring retailer, both, you know, I sort of browsing on the site, ordered my samples. I got an email from an individual saying, I am your point of contact now. I am your representative. I'm going to guide you through this whole process. Customer service that these big guys just cannot do.
No. I mean, B&Q is investing in its website as well as part of this plan. Maybe it probably won't be able to do that type of service, I imagine, but it'll be interesting. Also, the other interesting thing, very quickly, is I'm conscious of our time, but you've obviously got the sale of Homebase happening. Wes Farmers, big Australian company, is coming over to buy it, bringing in a new brand, Bunning, can't remember which one. And so that's an interesting potential development in this market as well. And another reason why we're sort of on hold with Kingfisher, because we're not quite sure yet how Wes Farmers will operate. You know, will it go hard discount, or will it just be a good rival to Kingfisher? It's just a bit uncertain.
Yeah, well, I haven't set foot in a home base in years, and there's a reason for that. anyway, general retailers down 3.7% over the year. So not awful, not brilliant either.
Not awful, not brilliant. And it's the same thing that we're just discussing now, which is the challenge that a lot of general retailers are having to fight on two fronts. A lot of them have an existing store estate, and then they're having to set up an online offering that competes with some really sort of disruptive groups that just literally operate off the web. And I'm not saying those groups don't have overheads, of course they do, they have distribution to sort out, but you know, unless you're someone like Next, which had an existing directory business and so had all of that distribution in place, you know, you've been having a very expensive few years.
Absolutely. Construction and materials was the fourth best performing sector. That will include companies like Howden Joinery, which is a trade focused kitchen supplier, Travis Perkins, which owns Wickes. So I mean, it's a market that's definitely, you know, good for investors potentially.
Yeah, I mean, it just suggests that you have to go sort of on the construction side as opposed to the retail side. You know, it seems like I know the new chief executive at Marks and Spencers has been described as a real trader, and that's what they think is good for a company like Marks and Spencers. Maybe that's just not true of the sort of home improvement side of things.
No, well, we shall see. We shall see. And I guess that kind of wraps up.
I think so.
Well, it certainly has filled up the time that we have available to us. Lots going on in the magazine this week. As I said, it's the FTSE 350 special. So the company's team have been working very, very hard putting together a 40-page supplement looking at every sector within the FTSE 350 and giving their lowdown on what to expect in the year ahead and which companies might prosper and which ones might struggle. That's really the main feature of the magazine. There is lots of other stuff in the news section. We've got CMC coming to market. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Simon Thompson's talking about some bear market signals.
Simon Thompson's bear market strategies are very, very worth listening to. Really telling you how to survive the bear market. Nicole Elliott, the trader, is talking about money creation in response to a reader letter. She's put a particularly excellent column there together. It's double the length of her usual columns and worth a read. Lots in the personal finance and fun section, which they will talk about on their podcast. The usual tips, obviously, this week. Sex Focus, Daniel's written on aerospace.
Yeah.
Interesting times there.
Exactly, cyclical decline or along the supply chain there.
Difficult one again. What's aerospace done this year? Not great, is it? Minus 16%.
Dear.
Yeah. Defence might be bouncing back.
Defence might be, but we don't know about civil aviation yet.
No, that's true. Stock screens, Algy's gone back to his Petrovsky screen. Is that how you pronounce it? And we're starting to get a few more results coming back again after our sort of Christmas lull on the results front. So it's all going to start getting busier over the next few weeks.
Indeed.
Okay, so thank you, everyone. Thank you, Harriet. Thank you, Bradley. Thank you, Mark. Pick up the magazine in all good newsagents. £4.70, the FTSE 350 review. It's a real bumper issue. Definitely should set you up well for the year ahead. See you next week.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.